Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k. Welcome everyone to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast, where each week we bring you education and information that will help you take your next step in building wealth through real estate. I am your host, Lauren Wells, and joining me today is Whitney Elkins Hutton. Thanks for joining me today, Whitney.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so Whitney is the Director of Investor Education at PassiveInvesting.com, a co-author of the international number one bestseller, Resilient Women in Life and Business, host of the Passive Investing Made Simple and Multifamily Investor Nation YouTube shows and podcasts, as well as a partner in over $800 million in real estate, which includes 6,500 residential units, 7 express car washes, and more than 2,200 self-storage units across 11 states. So she really has done it all, practices what she preaches, and I am so excited to have you here today, Whitney. You know, tell me a little bit about how did this journey start? You obviously are very heavily involved in passive investing, educating about it, doing it yourself, which we don't see very often at this scale. I feel like, you know, people passively invest, but, you know, to be involved in not just one asset class, but multiple and doing it at scale. You know, how did this journey begin?
Well, it began back in 2002. I bought a house with a significant other. The relationship fell apart about a month later and I had the house. I had everything, all the bills, everything under my name. I panicked a little bit and stuffed the house full of roommates who didn't mind living in a construction zone. I mean, back at this time, the house hadn't been redone since the 60s. And just imagine green shag carpet and psychedelic painted all over the wall. Beautiful hardwood floors underneath though. But anyways, paid people, did a lot of the rehab myself, but paid my friends in beer and sushi and pizza. Put the house back together in 11 months. And I thought I had to sell it at that point in time. I was just like, just get out from underneath this thing as quickly as possible. Don't let it sink me.
Yeah.
When I sold the property though, it dawned on me that I hadn't been paying my housing bill the whole entire time. Property, insurance, taxes, and you know, all of that. Principal, interest, taxes, insurance. I hadn't been paying all that. My roommates had been covering that. My roommates had been covering all the utilities. I'd actually been putting cash in my pocket every month.
Awesome.
And I walked away with like over $52,000, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, but you need to make that in 11 months when I
made
that traveling 80 hours a week for my job. That was amazing money. So I was like, wow, how many more of these projects can I do on the side? And so I spent several years doing what we call now live and flipping and house hacking and got really good at building up buckets of equity. I learned how to leverage the IRS tax code, the 121 exclusion, in order to keep a lot of those earnings tax-free.
Yep.
My husband, now husband, joined me, my antics, as I call it, and we did several projects together. And then it dawned on us one day that we were good at creating equity, but really horrible at creating cash flow. And that was what was going to unlock the golden handcuffs, if you will, financial independence, financial freedom. But we just didn't have the vocabulary, right? Like, have you ever been sitting there yearning for something and you're just like, I wish I could find somebody doing this. I didn't have the network. I didn't have the vocabulary. Once I finally landed on the vocabulary, started digging into this world of people that are actually creating wealth for themselves, financial independence, apart from stocks, bonds, and mutual fund, like just the world opened up for us. So we built a portfolio of over 30 single family homes. We bought an apartment building. There's several things, milestones along the way, but all led to one pivotal point where we were very active in our investing. And so it still required our attention and our time. And here I am, we're both working full time. We have a small kid at home. I'm a guardian over my grandparents. My mom is ailing. I was like, I don't have any more time. I can't scale this any further. And then we were like, wait a second, remember those two deals we did in your self-directed IRA? What were they called? Passive deals? You invested in a multifamily building. Remember? So that's when the light bulb kind of came on for us. We're like, okay, we got to go bigger, faster, and with less of our own time and resources. And when we started to unlock those keys, it dawned on us that we could not only scale our portfolio, scale our cash flow, scale our equity, scale our tax benefits. We did so without as much time involvement because we were leveraging other people's knowledge and expertise in that area, but we could also diversify our portfolio a lot better as well. Anyways, fast forward today to our personal portfolio side, which you mentioned, but I've also have a passion for educating people on how to do this for themselves. And that's what I do here as the director of investor education at passiveinvesting.com.
I love that. I think that switch from, okay, active to passive is a big transition because you may have cash flow. Like you said, you were cash flowing, but you were also very involved. So I want to talk about like making that transition and like how I think there's a lot of trust that goes into it, trust in who you're investing with and confidence in what you're investing in. So I'm sure you're thinking, and I know I would be thinking, how do I not lose money? Because I know when I'm in control, and maybe that's my type A self, that if I lose money, it's something on me and I'm more in control so I can mitigate that, or so you think, you know? So how do you flip your mindset and build that trust and learn how not, like, what are the ways not to lose money, I guess, as a passive investor?
Well, yeah, but I think you hit the nail on the head, right? The first thing as a passive investor, you have to learn how to do is to vet the operator. And everybody has their vetting spreadsheets. But when you look at those big, long spreadsheets, I mean, there's so many people out there sharing their spreadsheets on how they perform due diligence on a deal. They're really trying to get at 7 to 8 red flags. Now, I want to just also level set everybody's expectation. I still have some active real estate investments. And I'm reminded every year when I have to place a tenant or make a large repair that there's a reason why a majority of my portfolio is built with partners. We are going through that pain point right now, you know, dealing with some plumbing issues at one property and trying to sell another one. But bringing it back to like performing due diligence on the operator, the operating team, and just trying to suss out these red flags, this is how you don't lose money. If one of these red flags is in a deal, it's more than likely a deal breaker, at least for me. Now, so the first thing is, you know, making sure that the team has successful business and real estate experience. If they don't have any success in business or in real estate, you really should think twice about, do you need to take your hard-earned dollars that you've traded time for and to invest there, right? Now, everybody has to start their business somewhere, right?
Yes.
But if you're the operator, go find somebody who has that track record, knowledge, and expertise and partner with them until you've built it for yourself, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of the, you know, that will help get you as an operator to the next level.
I want to ask a question on that because like when you look at someone who has a track record, say the past 4 years where we were clearly in a booming market, as someone evaluating, do you look at that and say, okay, well, it's been anyone made money in the last 3 years?
Like, we all look like geniuses.
Yeah, we did. You know, so like all these operators out there who started 3 years ago, you know, look amazing. But I guess, does it cross your mind to look at, like, I'm not saying, because I'm not a fan when people are like, oh, you haven't been in this long. And it's like, oh, a decade, but they want 25 years because have you been through a downturn market? Have you been through a recession? So something you think about when you see sponsors who really have done very, very well, but it's been only in the last 3, 4, 5 years where, again, clearly we were in a huge flourishing market.
Yeah, it definitely is something, you know, forefront on my mind. And I want to understand how somebody has been tested.
Yeah.
Just think about this. This is how I approach this, all my questioning with an operator. Is I, as the investor, as a limited partner, I am hiring a COO of my real estate business. Now, I might have multiple COOs. I might work with multiple operators, as anybody should, because you can vary your operator, your market, and your deal as a limited partner. Okay. I'm hiring a COO, right? I'm giving up that day-to-day operational control. So that's the, now we're not talking about operating coordinator. I'm talking about a COO. That is what I am looking for. Somebody that has high level knowledge and expertise. So what is their, how far back have they been investing in real estate? Have they taken some hard knocks? How did they deal with them? Right. I'm not looking for like an A+ scorecard. I'm looking for somebody who has been challenged that in business and or real estate, it can be nimble with the environment that's at hand. I want to understand that they can actually navigate all these choppy waters ahead of us. And again, this is not a knock to people that are new. If somebody is not new, somebody on that team has to have this knowledge or expertise. They have to have a strategic partner. If I'm looking at somebody that's only been operating since 2019, okay, maybe they went through COVID, but who's the strategic partner there that helped them get through that and navigate those waters? That's what I want to see.
Yep.
I want to see that depth in that bench.
Okay. Awesome. So that's number one, like basically what is their track record? What is their performance in the space?
Yeah. Business or real estate, okay. Because you can take a lot of business skills and tangibly bring them into real estate.
Yeah.
It's a little harder to take just real estate skills and then go create a business, like an operating business. A little harder, I think, to go that direction, but I think it's fairly easy to take operating skills and pull them into real estate.
I love that.
Number two, are they full-time or part-time in their business? I'm looking, you know, I have a choice as a limited partner, and I choose to invest with people who this is their prime time. They are watching my money as if it's my money, not theirs, right? They're building this wealth, not only for themselves, but for their investors.
Yep.
And so again, you know, limited partners have a choice. Somebody's doing this part-time, their attention is going to be divided elsewhere. I'm also looking for teams that have at least two managing partners that are unrelated, if more, if possible. And that's just for succession planning, right? If you're scaling your own business and you're just a solopreneur, you know, what happens if you have a huge life event, right? We were talking before the show, we're both moms and we had kids that were in the hospital last month, right? We are the solo operators. That's a lot of hats to wear. So is there more than one managing partner and ideally unrelated? People are related, like a husband and wife. And I know some amazing husband and wife teams, but just think about it. If they don't have a third partner and something happens to one of their kids, guess what? Their attention's diverted, of course, as it should be, to taking care of that family emergency.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a question we get all the time. And I think is super important. Like, what is the succession plan? What happens? And like you said, if it is two people who are related, if something happened, typically it's affecting both of them in their lives. So yes, their attention would be diverted. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Making sure that now we're kind of getting down to the brass tacks of the actual deal, but making sure that the deal, I guess what's a red flag for me, if the deal doesn't have a preferred return, or if there's a preferred return, but the GP has slid in a catch-up provision. That is kind of a hard pill to swallow for me. I'm looking to work with operators that have well underwritten their business plan and are confident that they can deliver a preferred return to their investors and do so without putting in a catch-up provision where that allows them to get paid prior to the investor getting their capital back.
Yeah. So like skin in the game, essentially.
Exactly. A business alignment, right? Are the limited partners and the general partners truly aligned for performance? Modeling a refinance and a pro forma. This is another big one. If a business plan is predicated that you have to pull money out of the deal in order to make the deal work, that's a red flag for me. Now, it's not necessarily a deal breaker. Oftentimes what I'll do is I'll request the pro forma, right? The actual underwriting document. And I'll go in myself and back out that refinance.
Yeah.
On that spreadsheet. And if the numbers still work, great. Now we still have to talk about what happens to the lending. Then. Can the lending still carry on, right? There's still another hurdle to come across, you know, to work through there. But if the numbers still work with backing out that refinance, you still might have a deal to look at.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure if that was one of your red flags prior to COVID and now, you're probably doing pretty well if you weren't predicated on a lot of refinance.
Exactly. Which made deep value add strategies a little hard, you know, all these deals that were picked up with bridge debt. And I get it. I understand why operators were looking at bridge debt. It was created more cash flow on the deal. They could execute their business plan, repossession into more permanent debt in 24 to 36 months, maybe even do an exit and do so without paying, being locked out for a long period of time, do so without paying a prepayment penalty. But now interest rates have risen. Did they underwrite to this new interest rate environment? And I can almost guarantee you, nobody in the past 3 years knew where we were going to be at today.
Yeah.
So I know many operators that are renegotiating terms on their deals. They're securing rescue capital or even going a HUD route, which, you know, just to maintain the property, you know, getting a HUD loan on the property in order to maintain it. So past that, how are the distributions? Are they return on capital, return of capital? There's pros and cons to both structure, but at the end of the day, you're just penciling out the numbers.
Yeah.
An investor is going to make more money and it's going to be more aligned, business aligned, to have a return on capital structure as opposed to a return of capital structure. And that's just something when I talk to investors, they just don't understand.
Yeah. Do you want to clarify for people who might be listening and not understand what you're saying when you talk about that return of versus return on?
Yeah. So it's slightly difficult to understand and I'll do my best, but essentially on a return of capital account, your capital, you're not getting the return. You're not actually getting the preferred return on the deal. You're getting your capital count reduced to zero and then the pref is calculated. Whereas if your capital stays invested and your full capital account stays invested and the preferred return comes first, now you're getting a full pref, say it's 7% mm-hmm. on your return on your capital that's invested. And then as the deal, so the pref comes first, gets paid first. If there's extra cash flow, perhaps your capital count is now being reduced, but that pref is coming first, not second.
Yeah. That's an important concept to understand. And I feel like it's something that not going when you move from active to passive and working with more sponsors or operators is a question you should look into.
Yeah. You know, think of it like this, say you own your own private real estate, your own rental. Are you taking the cash flow and putting it in your pocket to reinvest and to spend, or are you taking the capital and considering you paying back your distribution or not your distribution, but your down payment? And then you take your return. Well, if you sell the property early, that return becomes lower on the back end, right? Whereas because you replenish your capital, whereas if I consume the capital and then I take my capital out on the backside, when I sell the property, my numbers are probably going to be larger on just how I book those numbers.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Creating Wealth Simplified. We wanted to take a moment and tell you more about our passive income fund at 7E, which is open to both accredited and non-accredited investors. Our latest offering targets an 8% annual return distributed monthly with the ability to potentially achieve a greater return through our bonus share program. If you'd like more information, reach out to us at invest@70investments.com to learn more. Thank you.
Love that.
There's a reason why operators do it and why some investors like a return of capital structure potentially for tax benefits. But at the end of the day, I wouldn't let the tax tail wag the dog.
So that kind of leads me to my next question. Do you look at the tax ramifications? Is it set up as a 10, are you going to get what tax form? K-1? Is it going to be ordinary income tax? Is it going to be, for us, we issue a 1099, it's considered qualified dividends, you know, that's more favorable. So do you look at that when you're evaluating, or is that a nice to have, but not something you consider a deal breaker?
Exactly. Right. That's a nice to have. It's not necessarily a danger to the deal or to the business plan and the operator's ability to perform. That's really what we're getting at is what are those things, those 7 or 8 things that are going to put the business plan most at risk? And how can we eliminate those? Once we've eliminated those, now we're getting down to what aligns best with your investing goals, your risk tolerance, and your timeline. And something do you get a 1099 or a K-1? Do you get monthly or quarterly distributions? That's all going to align with your goals and your timeline and your risk tolerance.
I like how you phrase that. So the first, essentially these first 8 red flags or 7 red flags are about evaluating the sponsor and the business plan and what could potentially put those things at risk and your capital, therefore, at risk. And the second part is they check all these boxes or 6 of the 7, they passed. Then you can go into, now does this align with my portfolio, my strategy, tax benefits, all of that. So kind of separate it, because I think a lot of the times when people are evaluating, they kind of mingle those two. And it kind of clouds I think it would cloud your judgment because, this is more tax beneficial and you're kind of seeing all these great things, but there could be something that in that first, those first seven buckets that really should be sticking out more, but you're clouded judgment because you're looking at the tax benefits or whatever it might be.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I'm in part of a mastermind and there's a deal being evaluated in the mastermind and everybody's like looking at the numbers. And I'm like, guys, hold on. We've got a red flag here. But I mean, not everybody is, for me, it's a red flag. It's a no-go. It's related to the operating partner in the business plan. There's something fundamentally there that I'm like, oh, this could really put everything at risk. I mean, that aside, whether we get like a 25 or 30% IRR, like this is going to put the whole thing at risk. It doesn't matter. If this goes wrong, that does not materialize. Those returns never materialize.
And I, yes, again, I think that's a great point because we'll get people who I'll speak with, they're like, oh, like I'm going to get like 17, 18, 19%. And I'm like, well, like you said, it goes back to look at the past performance, look at the, are they using leverage? What is their track record? Who is involved? What does that team look like? All these questions, you know, what is their succession plan? Because there's something wrong there. Like you said, it doesn't matter if you can get 18, 20, 24%. Will you is probably the better question. You know, are you better off going with something that's going to give you 10% and clearly checks all these buckets? So it's kind of, and I guess that also probably plays into like your kind of phase of life. What are your goals? Like there is something to be said about being more aggressive, but can you afford to be more aggressive? Is this your first investment? These are all things that I think about when I'm talking to people. So individual, every individual is so unique and what their, I guess, risk tolerance is as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, I know people that are swinging for the fences like in their 20s, but if you just didn't lose capital for, say, the first 10 years of your investment career and hit some sort of maybe financial vitality, financial independence level, now, once you get to there, you can start taking a little bit more risk until it's time for retirement, right? But I think a lot of people have been trained. We've all been trained.
I was just going to say that's interesting because I would think, because I see this, like what you see is like when you're in your 20s, you're just go big or go home. And then, you know, you're in your
30s. Everybody says you have time to make it up.
Yeah. But now being in your 30s, you might have more responsibilities of mortgage, kids, all of that. And you are kind of less risk averse. So what would happen if you did exactly what you said and you did build that financial freedom? You enter your 30s where you can take more risk because you do have that track record of success. And that's interesting. I've never thought of it that way. I've always thought of it the opposite way because that's what I see and that's what I'm around.
And that's what we've been told all our life. Like go 100% stocks in your 20s. Like you got time to make it up. Stock market crashes. I wish I had all that time. I wish I had the money back. Trust me. But more importantly, I wish I had that time back.
Yeah.
I wish like I had learned how to do this. This is why I'm so excited for my daughter, even though like she's just like, mom, stop talking about investing at the dinner table. Like, I am so excited for my daughter because she now has these money skills. She knows how to do this. She's going to be able to put these to use so much earlier in her life. She's already investing alongside of me. I wasn't doing this. I was investing in my dad, but helped me buy stocks of Coca-Cola and Dr. Pepper. I'm 6 years old. And let me tell you, that didn't really get me anywhere.
Oh my gosh. So are there any other things that you would say are red flags or things that you definitely take a look at before making a decision whether or not to invest? Or I guess before looking at if this is a fit for your portfolio?
Yeah. So two more. One is no co-investment from the general partner. And I would actually even say you want to look for a co-investment above and beyond the acquisition fee. Again, you want to, you know, everybody has to get started in the business somewhere. So who is that strategic partner, that key partner that is going to make that investment, put their money on the line, skin in the game? But because if they have significant skin in the game, they're going to take better care of that asset because they're taking care of their money too.
Well, and the business as a whole.
Exactly. And the last one is, you know, make sure that the loan is, if it is an adjustable rate loan, that it's capped. And I would actually go one step further that there's not only that there's an interest rate cap, but there's a plan to pay for the next cap or the cap extensions if they need it. So that's what's getting, I think not many people are talking about this right now. The price of interest rates caps are stabilizing and maybe even I heard in some markets coming down. But what has gotten a lot of people in hot water in the past 6 to 9 months and will continue so probably through the end of this year into early 2024 is they purchased a property using an adjustable rate loan. Maybe they were smart and they put an interest rate cap on it. If they didn't put a cap on it, ooh, they're in trouble right now.
Yep.
But maybe they did put a cap on that rate, but did they underwrite to the fully capped rate from day one? Now people are doing that now. Okay. They're still using bridge debt, which is totally fine. They're paying for the cap and they're underwriting at that cap from day one. That's smart. That can be smart business. There's a business case for that. Now where people are still getting into trouble, even they had the adjustable rate loan, they got capped. They hit the cap and they might still be eking out a little bit of cash flow even now, is that what happens when they have to go get that permanent debt or pay for another bridge loan to keep their cash flow going and pay for that cap again? So maybe that cap on, say, I'm just throwing out some numbers and you guys don't quote me on this, but it gives you the perspective, a $50 million property a year and a half ago, or even 2 years ago, that cap on a $50 million property probably cost you $100,000, maybe closer to $70,000. That cap on that property today, that interest rate cap on that property today, probably it'll easily be like $1.5 to $2 million. That's 10 to 20x times the cost. And so that's where we're seeing a lot of operators. They might still be, the asset's still cash flowing, but they have to pause the cash flow on the asset because they know they have to probably pay for another cap going forward here in the near future. And the bank actually might already be escrowing for that cap right now. And so taking it out of adding it to the mortgage payment. So those are just some things. And there's nothing you can do about backwards looking other than trying to come up with another solution, right, for the debt and lending. But if you're evaluating a deal right now, looking forward, make sure that fixed rate debt, if it's there, great. It doesn't, again, there's always a business case not to use it. If it is a bridge debt or, you know, floating rate, there is a cap and it's fully underwritten at that cap right now today, starting from day one, the day they close.
And that kind of leads into my last topic that I kind of want to cover really briefly is today, very different economic climate, investing climate than a year and 2 years ago. What would be your strategy as a new passive investor who doesn't want to lose money? And I do believe that there's a lot of opportunity right now, but what would, I guess, if you're just starting out, if you could take yourself back and, or if this was your daughter, what would be your advice to her starting today?
Well, you know, there's always the headlines, right? I don't invest according to the headlines. And, you know, I stopped doing that several years ago. And I really had to go back and look at principles. Like, what are those underlying principles that Ray Dalio, Warren Buffett, the Rothschilds, the Vanderbilts, they all invested by? And how can I put myself in the best position to hedge the market, whether it's going up, down, or sideways? And, you know, really, there's seven that I've landed on. You know, we can cover pretty quickly right now. Happy to go through all seven. But for me, I challenge everybody, list out all of your investments. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds. I help people work through this in our boot camps here at passiveinvesting.com. We go through opportunity costs. And we also go through how to survive a recession in one of our boot camps. But break out all of your assets, all your holding, all your property, all your passive investments, and grade them on these categories. One, how well are they going to preserve capital? Okay. Again, when you're underwriting, performing your due diligence, these are the things that you're trying to figure out. How well is my capital going to be protected? All right. Two, how stable is the cash flow right now on that asset? And what is the plan to grow it? Now, I know people, I talk to investors all the time. You probably do too. They're like, I don't need the cash flow right now. I got a great paying job. Like, I'm just going to like make me, I don't want an investor that was like, I want to make tons and tons of money right now. And I'll worry about the cash flow later. I'm like, ooh, okay. You're swinging for the fences, right? So the cash flow, you can always take the cash flow and put it back into more investing, right? And then if you need to, something happens in your life, a year or two from now, you can flip that cash flow on. You can start consuming it. I always look for cash flow. I look for ways that the property is going to produce equity. Now, there's natural market appreciation, but more importantly, I'm looking at how the operator is going to increase the income, decrease the expenses, and add additional streams of income. Because when they do that on an institutional grade property, they can actually control the value of that property. And they can actually make money on that property in a declining market. I know it sounds really weird for people who are new to passive investing. That is how operators, if they can increase the NOI of the asset, even in a market where the cap rate is expanding, the market is softening, they can still make money on the asset. That's what you want to look for. Tax benefits. How does a particular property or investment produce tax benefits for you, right? And really the tax benefits, everybody says, I don't want to pay the IRS man, right? It's moreover creating velocity with your money because you're going to take that savings and pump it right back into your wealth building. That is how people start hitting these hockey stick growth curves with their investing, is constantly taking the cash flow, constantly taking the equity, constantly taking the tax savings and pumping it right back into their investing. The first 5 or 6 years is like watching paint dry, guys. Honestly, but then you start hitting this hockey stick growth. And that's, you know, part of that is leveraging the tax savings, utilizing depreciation, accelerated depreciation, bonus depreciation, utilizing 1031 exchanges. Now, again, I don't let the tax tail wag the dog, right? You don't just, you know, I don't go into an asset just because of the tax benefits. It is a great nice to have. Mm-hmm. And then the other things we kind of already touched on is like, what is the smart use of lending? Right? We already kind of picked that one apart in our red flag. How does that asset hedge inflation? How well can I adjust, not only like lock in debt, like if we use the true term of inflation hedging with real estate, it is putting permanent debt or variable rate debt on the property and letting the devaluation of the dollar, inflation of the dollar, erode the asset, erode the lending on the asset. But you can also look at it a different way. Is how often can I increase the income and expenses and pass that through to the end customer? Okay, essentially outsourcing all of my bills on that property and boosting my income. And then number 7 comes right back full circle, the operator. Now, a lot of people might be scratching their head and they were like, well, I'm doing this all on my own. I don't need an operator. Guess what? You're the operator. So you have to be the expert in your area of investing, in your market, in your strategy. Right. So those are the ways that you're going to hedge inflation, is making sure that your investments have as many of those pillars to them. And I would, like I said, when I finally landed on these 7 pillars, I went back and graded all my assets. I could tell you my most valuable assets that were total nail biters for me to have in my portfolio only had 1 or 2 of those pillars. I was like, I have to reposition my money and get into assets that adhere to more of those pillars.
Awesome. Well, this is such a great conversation. And if people are interested in learning more about passive investing or want to connect with you, where can they do that?
Yeah, pretty simple. You can join me at passiveinvestingwithwhitney.com. There, you can get a free ebook on how to get into passive investing called Passive Investing Made Simple. You can get a free checklist if you're not into reading ebooks. I got a 2-page checklist. I got the Cliff Notes version. You also can get access to my calendar. We can talk all things passive real estate. And yeah, you can also find me on LinkedIn, but that's the easiest way to get a hold of me is passiveinvestingwithwhitney.com.
Love it. I'd actually be curious to see how many people reach out on LinkedIn or some time with you. I always feel like people are all, I'm always throwing it out there and very few people come through. And I'm, you know, this real estate community is so helpful and encouraging. And so I urge you, if you're listening to this and you want to get started with passive investing, to find some time on Whitney's calendar. She is a wealth of knowledge and super successful on her own and with helping other people. So thank you so much for joining us today, Whitney.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure. Yes.
And thank you everyone for listening to this episode of the CWS podcast. If you enjoyed the show, share it with a friend, subscribe, or leave us a review. Until next time, thank you.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.